I think the Canadian government should get their ass in gear and just make some people readers. Don't you think that'd be a great job? Like, what do you do? I'm a reader now. You know, I got this 5-year gig. So what do you do? I read all day long.
Oh, I love that. I love that, man.
Joe, how do you say it in Japanese? And how do you say it in English?
Writers read their old.
Thanks, man.
Is it a special kind of silence they're trying to hear? I don't think so. Just everyday silence. What do they do when they hear it? They record it, he said. The silence we hear today is different from the silence we heard 10 years ago. And that's where GLG's research comes in handy. They can track how the same silence sounds different and how it's grown and changed over the years. How can they tell? Tell what? Tell the difference between one silence and another. I don't know. They have some pretty cool equipment. Have you ever heard one of the recordings? Yeah, I did once. Gallo played a recording for me. What did it sound like? It sounded like nothing at first, but then after a while, it didn't sound like anything at all. Welcome back to Writers Read Their Early Shit, conversations with authors and artists about the lopsided pleasures of their pre-developed, over-early, unripe work. I'm your guide, Jason Endy, down in the groove in rainy Gifu Rock City, Japan. And my special guest this episode is the author of 4 books of poetry, Memoirs of an Alias, Emergency Hallelujah, Natural Capital, and Hard Work Cheering Up Sad Machines. He's also the author of 3 novels, Good Evening, Central Laundromat, We Wish You a Happy Kill Day, and Amusement Park of Constant Sorrow. Good at titles, this guy. His most recent publication is the short story collection Survivors of the Hive, which came out this year from Radiant Press, and which includes the story Tell Me Again How the Silence in the Chamber of Exaltation Sounds, which I quoted from briefly just a minute ago. Another great title. So born in Montreal, he went to Kingston in 1990 to attend Queen's University and has lived there ever since. He was the Poet Laureate for the City of Kingston from 2019 to 2022. He works at Service Ontario and lives with his wife and their 3 cats, Akira, Pablo, and Neruda. Clearly good at naming cats, too. He says, when I sit down to write a poem or piece of fiction, I don't purposely start from a surreal perspective. I begin with an image or a scene or a bit of dialogue and see where it leads. I find things eventually take a surreal turn simply because surrealism gives me the most freedom to go where I please. Distinguished listeners, it's Jason Haru. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you, Jason. I'm glad to be here. I really appreciated your reading earlier, man. That was a well done. Great recital.
Oh, thank you. It's a great story.
Thanks, man.
Good morning to you. Well, it's morning for me. It's early evening for you, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
I've never been to Kingston, but I was just reading a Pierre Burton book, as you do. And it's sort of all these weird stories about from the Canadian past. And there was one about a pirate. And that area, Kingston, is it still called the Thousand Islands?
Yeah, Thousand Islands. That's still a name that's around here. There's a Thousand Island cruises, and I believe there are still a thousand islands around the area.
Right.
So some of them are small, some of them are larger.
Are there still pirates?
I'm sure there are still pirates. Yeah, absolutely.
It was an interesting story about this wacko pirate, and he sort of had secret bases in the islands, and then he would do raids on Kingston and so on. And I didn't, and then there was a bit about the Kingston Penitentiary, which I didn't know anything about. So I was checking that out, and I thought, well, that's yet another place I have to get to eventually. Is it worth, I mean, apart from seeing you and the penitentiary, is it worth visiting Kingston?
Yeah, there's something special about this city. I mean, partly it's the history, like what you just mentioned, all the strange, you know, historical little nuances that it's an old town, lots of ghosts, I guess, hanging around here. But it's also very beautiful. It's you know, it's lovely in the spring and summer. In the wintertime, it's a bit like being on the moon here, but it's still really nice. When I moved here, I came from Montreal, a larger city, and I just fell in love with the size of the city and the people in it. And yeah, there's a lot to offer people here.
How big is it population-wise?
Oh man, I'm not very good with data. You'd have to ask Pierre Burton about that.
Okay. Yeah. He's coming up next with his early shit. Yeah. Okay. All right. So I have some writerly type questions for you.
Yeah. Cool.
First of all, I sort of reject the term guilty pleasures, particularly when it comes to reading. I guess there are some pleasures that you should feel guilty about, but not for reading, because that just sort of, to me, smacks of gatekeepery and, you know, kind of elitism or whatever you know, and I think we should be allowed to enjoy what we enjoy. But I prefer the term comfort reading.
Yeah.
You know, just something that you can relax into. Now I'm a big Stephen King guy. That for me is perfect comfort reading. How about you? First of all, are you quite disciplined with your reading? Are you always reading something that will help you, or, you know, make you a better writer or whatever it is? Or are you sort of half and half? Do you like to sink into your own comfort reading, whatever that is?
Yeah, not a lot of comfort reading going on in my life, I'm afraid. I'll just kind of read stuff that I'm compelled to read, that I really feel like, you know, I gotta dive into this. And even when I'm reading something to learn about and to kind of learn from the experience of reading from it, very rarely will even finish a book these days.
Really?
Or even start a book at the beginning. I'll pick up a book, I'll dive in the middle. And maybe it's just the way, you know, I've loved reading poetry all my life. Maybe that I'm just approaching that kind of magpie haphazard approach to fiction and prose as well. I won't start at the beginning. I'll start in the middle. I'll pick pieces through more like a buffet style. So, my reading habits aren't that great at the moment, but, guilty pleasures. I think, you know what? I'll pick up now and then, and I'll have a few copies lying around or from the library, The Hardy Boys.
Oh,
I don't know
what
it is. I'll pick that up just for fun, nostalgic, but there's just something about it. Like, it's just the plot, the way things click together. It's just a lot of fun.
Oh man, you've just won me over, Jason. I read sort of all of them when I was a kid. And
yeah.
I had the whole, you know, shelf full of the blue, those blue
hardcovers. Oh, they were beautiful. Great, great titles. Talk about great titles, great titles, great cover images. Have you gone back to them recently, Jason?
Yes, I have, because one of the shows on this podcast, I read some of my own early shit, which was my first novel, which was an entirely plagiarized version of The Tower Treasure. I believe I just called mine The Hardy Boys, and I wrote it in grade 2 or 3 or something.
Oh, that's brilliant. Brilliant.
But then I bought it again and reread it, and it was great. And then I found there's a notebook shop in Portland where they take old books and just use the covers. I was checking out their website, and they have Hardy Boys notebooks. So it's the actual, I'm clutching one right now in my hands. It's, it's what happened at midnight. And then it's the blue hardcover. Then you open it up, and there's you remember on the inside, there would be those little drawings from a bunch of the books.
Course.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they have included some interior pages, like Joe and Frank are running down what looks like a subway track. And the table of contents is there, title page, and then one or two pages from the start of the story. I don't know how well you remember what happened at midnight, but chapter one is called Burglars. It starts off, what an assignment, and from our own dad. Yeah.
That is priceless. That's great. Oh man. What's funny, one of the projects I'm working on now is a collaborative poetry manuscript. Myself and my good friend Stuart Ross, we're taking all those titles from the first series, because I know they've gone on and on, but that first original series, I think there's about 61 or 62.
Yeah.
We're just taking the title, and then we just wrote a sonnet of whatever we wanted with that title.
Oh.
So we have a book that we're working on where it's a sonnet from each of us, and each sonnet that we write is going to have the same title, and we're just going to move through the whole series.
That's a great idea. I can't decide which one I'm looking forward to most. Which was the one? Do you remember the one offhand that was about a circus, and there's a guy on the front with a tattoo? It was something about the whale tattoo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think there must be the mystery of the whale tattoo. It's either the mystery or the case or the clue. But I think that was the mystery of the whale tattoo.
That's a good one. Secret of Skull Mountain.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Man. Yeah.
The Disappearing Floor. Mm. Classic. Okay. That's wonderful. All right. Yeah. Well, this is sort of linked, I suppose. I find that my comfort reading is that because it's comfortable. I don't find it too demanding. And then when I'm reading other stuff, you know, I'm often confused or lost?
Yes,
Or how good are you at just letting yourself be confused by a text you're reading? I mean, I get this from all kinds of stuff that I read, but particularly from poetry. I'll read a poem through and I'll go, what on earth? You know, that feeling of being stupid again, at least at first. How good are you at just being comfortable with confusing text?
That is actually, that's my comfort zone.
Really?
You know, and it's actually how I approach my own writing, is a sense of bewilderment. So I won't try to make sense of things. I'll just kind of go along with it. And I think, it's one of the things I love. I mean, you mentioned poetry. Poetry can be cryptic. It can be hard to kind of figure out. And if you're trying to find a meaning in a poem, you can struggle. It can set you up for failure. I think that's one of the challenges with teaching poetry in a classroom setting, because part of a classroom is to learn something, to analyze something. And a good poem will avoid all that. It's really just the experience of it. Yeah, that bewilderment, that sense of confusion, that's scary in the real world. But I think I love the way literature and art in general, like some modern art does that very well too. Like, what's that painting about? Mm. You know, but it's a safe place to feel bewildered. And I keep going back to that for sure. I love that feeling.
Okay. Maybe I should give it another try. start trying to enjoy my bewilderment a little bit more.
Yeah. Okay. Right on.
This is not literary, but I think it counts. What song would you like to hear play every time you walked into a room full of, okay, to make it literary, full of other writers? It's a big literary conference, you know, seminars, readings, and so on. What song plays every time you strut into the hall? You know, just mystically plays.
It's got to be something from the Reverend Al Green. I love Al Green songs. Whenever I'm at a restaurant and, you know, they say, hey, but then remember after closing the joint down, and say, what song do you want to end out on? Put on Al Green. It just changes the mood so much. So yeah, something smooth and easy to listen to. I think, an Al Green tune would be my go-to.
Okay. A little slinky. Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. If you could be mentored by any writer, living or dead, who would you choose?
Oh man. Yeah. And I guess mentorship could be a lot of things, but just to spend time with, I mean, someone who I kind of admire and I learned from, I guess in a way I was mentored just by reading so much of his work, was the Swedish poet Thomas Tranströmer. I really love his poems and his material. And I grew up as a writer, you know, learning what he was doing and watching, like lifting up the hood on some of those poems and trying to figure them out and putting my own spin on them, kind of like what you did with the Hardy Boys book. But the funny part is, I mean, if being mentored by a Swedish poet, Thomas Tranströmer, I probably need, you know, maybe Robert Bly or someone else around to translate, just to kind of make sense of things. But
so Robert Bly and this Swedish guy are sitting in a room and you walk in and Reverend Al Green starts playing.
Yeah.
And...
Oh man, that's amazing. That sounds lovely.
That sounds pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Frost, who said, you know, I think he was talking just about poetry, but I think it applies to most writing. He says it's never an idea at first. It's a homesickness. It's a lovesickness. You know, it's a throb up the spine or whatever.
Yeah.
When you get that, do you usually know from the start whether it's going to be a poem or a short story or the beginning of a novel, or does that only become clear later when you sit down to write it out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I normally know from the beginning, from that original impulse, whether it's going to be a poem or fiction or prose. And I don't know what that feeling is, but I think it's, there's a sense of clarity, with a poem. Like it's just, things are just in place. You know, there's a transparency involved. There's just that feeling. And I find a prose fiction, it's a bit of there's not that clarity. It's more of a messiness. There's just more things happening there. And it's like a tangled knot and poetry is more of the untangling of that knot. So they're almost kind of a little bit like opposites, but I find prose and novels, short stories, that's like something bubbling over, you know, and a poem is more of a stillness, of a clearing, I guess. Yeah.
Are you a notebook guy? Are you scribbling ideas and images and bits of conversation down in notebooks?
Yeah, definitely. That's really how I approach, I guess both poetry and prose, but how I'll write a piece of prose is I'll get a notebook and I'll just fill it with stuff. I'll just fill it. And then once I'm full, once the notebook's done, I'll say, okay, what do I have here? You know, now it's time to make the meal, and I'll kind of just look at it and I'll see what I can put together. So some things are really, you know, you wouldn't think they're connected, but because they're in the same notebook, I'm going to try to see, well, what is the connection? There's got to be a connection somehow between these things. Mm. There's a connection between that guy that was walking naked to the park and this other thing that I saw, you know? So it's like, and what is that connection? So it's almost like you're a detective trying to put the clues together, and the notebook is the evidence.
Okay. Well, then you sort of answered the second part of that question, which would be, you know, are you comfortable with sort of putting things in a notebook, putting them down, and then putting them on the shelf for a little while for later in case, you know, those, you might use that onion later.
The naked
onion in the park with Pierre Burton. Yeah.
There you go. There you go. Now there's a great title. Talk about a great title.
The naked onion in the park with Pierre Burton. That is pretty good. Okay. This is a question I've sort of always wanted to ask on the podcast and never have had the right chance, but might be today. Do you think there are any good movies about writers?
Yeah. You know what movie I really loved? Patterson. I think it was a Jim Jarmusch film with, and who's the guy? Adam Driver, I think.
Yeah.
He's a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Patterson. Yeah. It takes place in Patterson, New Jersey, but it has nothing to do with William Carlos Williams. Adam Driver plays a bus driver who writes poetry on the side. And so he has a job, you know, but, he has a notebook, and you'll hear some of the poems and voiceover as he's kind of writing them. And some people know he's a poet, but he hangs out with friends. It's just everyday life. But I think that's an amazing, movie about a writer. I mean, even, I'm even his routine, even the way he, you know, he wakes up, he has his clothes, on a chair near his bed. There's like four or five things that he does that I recognize. It's almost like that's my life that they're describing right there. Just little scenes that he does. So not necessarily the writing part, but the habits and routines of a writer are captured nicely in there.
Okay. Well, when they make a movie about you as a writer, I know it's, well, now we have the title, The Naked Onion in the Park with Pierre Burton. Who plays you in the film if they start production tomorrow? Johnny Depp?
No.
Adam Driver?
I don't know, man. That's a good question. Your ego gets involved in all these questions, right? I mean,
sure.
I said they go against typecasting. Let's get Danny DeVito in there.
DeVito.
Yeah, let's get somebody. Let's get a bit of a shocker in there.
I think I'd want Mr. T to play me.
Nice.
Maybe we can meet in, you know, maybe it's a whole series, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we fight at the end, you know.
Yeah. That would be pretty cool. Yeah.
That would be pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Okay. I'm going to start shopping that around. have you ever been on a literary pilgrimage?
I guess the closest, not really a pilgrimage. The closest thing that I've been to would be, I went to go meet Al Purdy at his place one afternoon. And that was someone that I when I was a younger writer, I looked up to him. He was one of the first Canadian poets that, you know, come across. And
yeah.
And so to have a chance to kind of, you know, Stephen Hyten, who passed away not that long ago, he was living just down the street from me, and we were kind of friends. And he knocked on my door one day and said, hey, you want to come join me to go visit Al? And I said, yeah, let's do that. That sounds great. So that was a very memorable event. Yeah.
How about some early shit, Jason?
Yeah. Thanks, Jason. So I went digging for some stuff because I don't know about other writers here, you know, when they read some early shit, but it's like, how do you find it? Like, where do you go for it? Because, I'm not one that really keeps a lot of those things, you know, filed away. So a lot of the stuff that I have hanging around would be stuff that would have been published, you know, mm-hmm. a while back, and that's not, maybe that's just early, but it's probably, you know, it's relatively good if it was published. But I wanted to go back to stuff that wasn't published, and I actually ended up finding a crazy little green notebook. It's like a 128 pages selectum notebook, the kind of thing you'd find in a classroom. And for whatever reason, during that time, I was kind of just writing complete poems in it. And they're all handwritten. You know, it's so weird to see that. This would be like 90s, like 97, 98. So I guess I was publishing a little bit, but it kind of hit and miss. And I was just trying to work on poems, and I found a few. So I have about like a dozen poems. We don't have to read them all, but I'll just get started and you let me know when.
Okay.
To stop. And I think maybe there might be a few that I'll comment on, but okay. I'll just dive in.
Sure.
Awake. Asleep one moment, awake the next. I curl over the covers like an unburied root. A high-heeled clock paces the room. The bedsheet sticks like a ninth skin. Everyone is busy and tired from working long hours, except for people like me who have no skills. The trees argue with themselves in wind. A mosquito keeps circling me hungry for blood belonging to us both.
High-heeled clock.
Yeah. A high-heeled clock. And as I'm reading this, I'm realizing like it's challenging to read the handwriting sometimes too. So if I stumble over something, it's just because I'm trying to make sense of it.
So in this crazy little green notebook,
yeah,
is this sort of a first draft? Has this been worked on?
Yeah.
Well,
you know what's so funny? I see this as it's all written out, and I must have had like napkins, like little fragments written all over the place, but it's all written out. The title is in brackets, so I don't know what that means. I don't know if that's like a placeholder title or if what. And I have the date. I have June 1st next to it, which I never date my stuff, but I guess because I was kind of putting into a notebook, I wanted to kind of. Oh, you know what? As I'm going through it, I see that there's a few others that have that same date. So no way did I write three poems in one day. It must have just been me kind of working on them and putting them in here.
Okay.
Yeah,
central place.
That makes more sense. Yeah.
When did you first start writing poetry?
I think I just started like scribbling. Oh, you know what? My first real interaction with with books and the written word was I was a toddler. I couldn't even read or write. I'd take these books off my parents' shelf. I'd pull them off. I'd open them up on the carpet. I'd take my crayon and I just scribble in them. I just make a big mess in my parents' books. And God bless them. They never yelled at me or punished me. They see me doing it. They take the book away. They put it back on the shelf. And then the next day I'd do it again. And I think that was just me. I think those scribbles are maybe my first kind of poems in a way. That's me interacting with books.
Sure. What sort of books were they? Novels? Were they sort of picture books? Like the Great Lakes or the Kingston Penitentiary or something? Or
they were heavy texts. Like there was like dictionaries. There was like stuff that was just like encyclopedias. There was just stuff with like dense wording in there. It could be anything. I don't think I have any kicking around anymore, but I remember seeing those books. I don't really have a memory of doing that. I was so young, but I remember seeing the books afterwards and kind of just seeing these wild swirls of color over the printed page.
I guess it could be seen as you trying to engage somehow with what seemed important, or it could also be seen as you trying to deface this stuff too. It's hard to say.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right about that. But I think, you know, I think I came to poetry later. I think I came to poetry when I was like in high school, that kind of prime age, 15, 16, 17. I'd written stories before that, you know, and there's just something, when I went to CGEP in Montreal, it's like between high school and kind of university. There's a 2 years CGEP in Montreal that you go to. And I just remember for the first time being exposed to a beautiful library and walking down aisles and aisles and aisles and able to kind of pull off a wide range of books from the shelves and discovering poetry on those shelves. Hmm. And honestly, the first thing that came to mind was, oh, this looks so easy. Here are some words that don't even have to go all the way to the end of a page. Why am I writing novels? Why am I writing stories?
Right.
Why not just write a poem? And there is something about it too that I thought, man, you don't need characters. You don't need any scenes. There's something very authentic about it as well. I think that's what really appealed to me.
Mm.
Here is just, you know, words on a page and there's not even much of a sequence involved. You don't have to know what's happening, you know, in the context, the backstory. There's
right.
just so you're just on that high wire act and that man. So yeah. On the one point, it looked easy. I think that's why I got into it. But once you start exploring that, you get so hooked. You get like, oh, like, and you don't need a lot of, you know, you don't need a lot of equipment to do it. You don't need a, you know, don't even need a camera. You just need a pen and a paper and And that's it. And you can squeeze one out in an hour if you're lucky.
An hour?
5 minutes?
5 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay.
16-year-old, 17-year-old teenage inspiration.
You got it. That's
and
right,
then
man.
Not only would it date the poems, but they'd be timed as well. You know, it would be it would be something about Hitler, you know, just to be something like Flowers for Hitler. I know that's a Leonard Cohen thing, but it would be, so we try to rip that off and it would be Fireworks for Hitler. And, you know, this scribbled in 5 minutes and then it would be, you know, February 2nd, 1989, 1:32 a.m., right? Yeah. Thinking that would be important to future scholars.
Absolutely.
But that's interesting too, because I, as a kid, I thought, I didn't even think about poetry. Poetry was this sort of monolithic Shakespearean, sort of super duper vintage, old weird language that I thought, okay, that's for old people or something. But starting with short stories or, you know, little proto novels or whatever, and partly realizing later this is a lot shorter and easier. But also, I don't know about you, I just wanted to be a rock star, and since I couldn't play anything except the clarinet, I thought, well, I can be the lyricist maybe, right? Because I'll, I thought, you know, because I, as teenage years, listening to you guys like Tom Waits and so on, thinking, yeah, these are great lyrics. I could maybe do this, and then of course, writing 2 years of rip off Tom Waits lyrics, you know, Steam and Oil and
All been there, man.
But then you sort of, I do find that interesting, because I started with, say, stories or whatever, moved into poetry, and and then from there maybe to creative nonfiction stuff, but never went back really to stories. But so you started doing both at the same time, stories and poetry and novels, right? So fiction.
And I guess, I mean, you know, I use the term novels and stories loosely, you know, at that age. I was working on stuff like that, trying, you know, thinking, yeah, this is what I would want, how I want to spend my days writing. And then poetry kind of became a way to kind of a new thing to focus on. You know, you mentioned how you saw poetry as that archaic kind of old fashioned style thing. And and you're right. That is really a lot of how it gets, you know, exposed to people in the beginning. But I think what I discovered when I was wandering through that library was the beat writers and how much fun that was, and how flippant and even socially aware they were. And, you know, just how mind expanding reading like Gregory Corso or, you know, Kerouac, even, you know, Lawrence Ferlinghetti,
Ginsburg,
like finding those guys.
Ginsburg.
Yeah. So that's when I realized poetry could be fun too. And once you realize that writing is fun, then that's it. You're a goner.
Yeah. Once you can get over that, all that sort of cliched imagery of, you know, sitting in your garret and it's really important and you're writing it in blood by candlelight and it's really important and weighty stuff. And once you can get over, and some people never do, right? And sometimes you can sink back into that as well and go, I'm important and smart and it really matters. Whereas, I think you're right about how it's taught. It's sort of dumped on your desk as this very important, very obscure, and it's almost a test of your intelligence. Can you figure out what it means?
Absolutely. You know? And so frustrating for people. It's like a museum piece, right? It's like, don't touch it. You know, you gotta look at it from a distance.
Don't get too close.
And we're gonna tell you about it. And then you add your thing to it. But
I know what it means, but you don't.
Yeah.
So you can try, fumble around for a bit, and then I'll point out all the ways that you're wrong and
you're
dance
wrong.
And so on.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's never presented as fun or lively or anything. That's why I think one of the reasons anyway that you, at least my gang and I, when we were teenagers, did gravitate towards lyrics and good lyricists with music, right? Because that was fun, because it was the added element.
Exactly.
It was sexy and cool. And
That energy.
Energy, yes. Because there was none of it in the classroom. You know, not that all my teachers were bad. It was just the way it was taught and so on. Yeah.
Oh,
and
I hear you.
And I was listening to Ada Limon on a podcast recently, and she was saying, look, try it out. And if you read a poem and you don't like that poem or that poet, there's lots more, man. Like,
yeah.
Which We don't worry about that with music. If somebody plays a song for you that you don't like, you don't think, well, that's it for music. I have to find something else to do all day.
Yeah.
But people do seem to do that with poetry, partly because of what happens early on, right? And they're like, okay, yeah. I don't want to feel dumb and unsexy anymore. I'll do something else, you know?
Yeah. No, yeah, really good point. Really good point.
Okay. Let's have some more.
Okay. Some more early shit, man. This one's called The Ambassador. Mm. Strangers call for the Ambassador Hotel. Wrong numbers, but the happiest human voices I've heard in some time. When they call in the middle of the night, I have trouble falling back asleep. When they call during the day, I lie down and dream. That one has a check mark on the left and a big X on the right. So I don't know if I liked it, if I didn't like it, but
or both. Yeah.
Or both, I guess, on different days. Yeah.
So these are just, that was that written as prose or
as poetry? That's written, it's a poem. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's 9 lines. Some are long, some are short. Mm. But it's, it's a poem. But you know what? I'll often kind of, when you're writing in a notebook, I'll often just write it as prose, even if it's a poem. I won't, because you'll get so blocked if you start breaking up lines in the early stages of things, when you're gathering material, you know, when you're gathering all the firewood, you kind of, you'll chop it up later.
Right.
So yeah, I don't really, a lot of my poems can start off as a chunk of prose, and some of my prose begins as just single lines on a page too. And then I'll kind of put them into a paragraph once I figure out what order they go in.
That reminds me of, speaking of the beats, when Ginsberg first started writing poetry, he was writing sort of very formal rhyming.
Yeah,
stuff.
That's right. Yeah, and the then, empty mirror. Yeah.
But then when he met William Carlos Williams and was sort of sending him his poems, Williams was saying, you know, no, it needs to be more natural language. So then Ginsberg went back to his journals and he would just take journal entries and put it as a poem on the page.
Oh, brilliant.
And then he sent those to Williams. And then Williams said, now you're onto something, right?
Right on.
I thought was interesting. Yeah. Yeah,
we, you know, we kind of get in our own way when we think we're creating something precious and you know, something's going to last
exactly.
generations, you know, right? But yeah, journal entry is just a jotting down. And so, yeah, you can surprise yourself by what you find in there.
Yeah. Do you think it's in large measure sort of a problem of, because again, maybe we never totally get over it. You're sitting down to write a poem and you're at least on some level back in the garret with a feather quill pen and a, you know, blood and and it's stormy outside and you're in a castle in Wales or something.
Yeah.
I don't know if that ever leaves entirely, but sometimes when you're just jotting and you're not thinking of it as a poem or a story or anything,
just the
jotting, then you can surprise yourself maybe.
Yeah. No, I agree 100% with that. If you sit down to write a poem, good luck, man. That blank page is not going to yield anything. But if you're going to sit down and just going to, you know, write down an impression, something, you know, and then it's kind of like, you know, a singer, you're going to warm up. You're going to clear your voice a bit. You're right. You're going to kind of, and that's going to be the first words on the page. You're going to get in tune. And then once you start going, you, something may happen or it may not. But often it's funny. Like if I'm running a journal, whether it's, if I'm trying to capture some impressions that I feel are a bit poetic, I never start with a poem. I'll start with the weather. I'll just start with like, what do I see immediately? How do I orientate myself in this moment? I'll, you know, and then from there, I'll kind of zoom in on something else that's happening.
Just mentioned the journal. So do you still keep a journal? Are you quite good at a daily jotting down of something or other?
Yeah, you know, I used to really stick to it daily. I used to be even down to like, I got to do 100 words a day, just like an assembly line, you know, and you know, there's something maybe to be said for that because you're gathering material. And then at the end of a year, you go back and you might find a few things in there. But there was just something about the force, the enforcement of that, that I kind of backed away from. So I don't compel myself to write in a journal every day. I find I do it most of the days, but my challenge is that I'll have a lot of notebooks on the go. I've gotten better at kind of labeling them. So if I think, oh yeah, this feeling that I'm in now, that might go well with that other stuff. So I'll just kind of, you know, add things to that. But yeah, that can be a bit, you got to be really well organized to when you got a lot of notebooks going.
Oh yeah. You need an elaborate system, classification system. It's true.
Yeah.
No, I struggled for years to sort of do that kind of daily.
Yeah.
I thought of it more as a diary type thing. I just got bored because if I'm just writing for myself, so pretentious or not pretentious enough.
Yeah.
But then I forget her name. Oh, maybe Linda Berry, I think is her name. And her suggestion was every day, just take a page, split it up into four. One bit is things you did that day. Try to write seven things you did. Doesn't matter what they are. Another section is seven things you noticed or saw. Another quadrant is things you overheard. And then the final quadrant is just sketch something you saw that day. It doesn't have to be, you know, beautiful art, just anything you saw, right? And I've found that easy to keep up.
Actually. Oh, that's amazing. Do you ever go back to those and find that there's things that are going to turn into maybe a literary project at some point? Or is it just, or does it,
does I think it, does so, not really yes, overlap? Because it's especially that not so much the things I did, because that's, you know, fed the cats, went to work, you know, but it's the little things I noticed or overheard. Yeah. And that's that's amazing. Rich trove. Yeah. But that's kind of like that girl I saw taking the picture of a hamburger that goes into that, right? So you never know when I think you have to let that kind of stuff simmer very far back in your mind or on the shelf for a long time. But then in a couple of years, you know, those notebooks might be very useful, you know, who knows? Yeah. That's the hope anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you particular about your notebooks or will anything do?
Anything will do.
Anything will do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. From expensive state of the art to like dollar store ones.
Yeah. do you have them displayed or are they locked away somewhere?
Good question. So they're kind of stacked. They're kind of piled. So they're very, they're not displayed. They're not locked away. They're easy to grab. My older ones, I struggle with what to do with old ones that I may not go back to, you know, things that stuff from like a decade ago, I might scan through them, see if there's anything interesting in there. If there isn't, I'm not going to keep it for posterity necessarily. I mean, although I'm glad I found this one and I'm reading from today.
So
it's funny, but in the past, what I have done, I had so many notebooks that, and it sounds strange to say this, but I tear the cover off. I tear two or three pages from that notebook and then I put into a frame, almost like the tombstone of that notebook, you know, like this is the notebook's no longer here, but this is a memory of that notebook of that time. Mm-hmm. And I'll be able to look at it and it'll remind me of, oh yeah, I remember writing that, but I won't have to store this. So I had about four or five. My vision was to have a whole wall of these, like, you know, a gallery of notebooks, but I had about four or five of them. And then I gave up on it, but I'm trying to figure out what to do with them. Cause, you know, there's so many on the go.
Yeah.
So it's hard to. Well, to know what to do.
I quasi got around this problem by getting a special notebook that is a summary of other less accomplished notebooks. So
there you go.
Once I finish one of the maybe, you know, 100 yen store notebooks, I'll go through it. And sometimes there'll be just a couple words, maybe a phrase, maybe a line, maybe an image. Then that gets copied into that gets upgraded into the next level.
That's really smart. That's really
notebook, which is an expensive hardcover one, which is then just full of the, you know, the prime.
Yeah.
I'm just flipping through the prime one here, which is just, and the first thing that I see is an ex-prostitute with no nose. See, that's quite good, man.
Wow. That is good. That is good. That is good.
Wherever the hell that came from.
That is good. What do you do with the old ones? Like after you've taken the lines from them and you put them in the summary notebook.
Yeah.
Do you destroy the old ones? Do you get rid of them?
Well, I guess they are displayed. I bought a shelving unit and then I just love to see them there, ragged and
Yeah, that's good. That's good. If you have the space for it, for sure.
Do you want to, would you like to read some more?
Okay, I'll read some more. And then there's something at the end of this notebook that I want to get to as well.
But okay.
Here's one. It's called After Rain. The soiled bandages of cloud are gone. All that is left of the rain are the contents of its pockets. One puddle in the street, staring up at the sky that haunts it. I'm realizing my stuff's pretty short and basically just a collection of images.
Again, was this written as, is it on the page as a poem or is it prose?
It's on the page as a poem. Yeah.
But the way you read it, it could be, it's hard to tell, right? It could be prose.
Yeah.
Too.
Well, you know what? It's true. I mean, basically I say it's on the page as a poem, but it's a sentence, you know, it's just broken up. It's just it's basically statements that I'm saying. I'm just collecting these statements the way they're read, the way they look, I guess would make them look more like a poem, but.
When you read stuff like that, does it bring back the writing of it? Does it bring back the time when it was written? Does it bring back the writer who wrote it?
Two poems in here do. And one of them is, one of them was a bit of a, it felt like a turning point for me. It was a bit of a breakthrough in all the poems I've read up so far on this show. A lot of images, a lot of similes and metaphors. And I still love similes and metaphors. And the stranger, the better. But I kind of, that was just my go-to, you know? But then I wrote something that had no images. I mean, no similes, no metaphors. And when I wrote it, it kind of expanded what my idea of what a poem could be. So this poem was never published, but I felt differently after I wrote this one. So I'll read this one now. It's called When There Is No One at the Bus Stop. When there is no one at the bus stop, there is no bus stop. You hear a voice in the street laughing, but do not hear why. There is a train whistle in the dark, calling from where it no longer is. A car drives by, going somewhere else. At night, you see a window light up where you forgot there was a house. You hear someone drop something on the floor overhead, but hear only silence when they pick it up again. And that's it. So no similes, no metaphors,
no.
Just this kind of a, this then nothingness going on where,
but there's also almost no people in it too.
No people. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. No
people. That is kind of interesting.
Yeah. I'll read one more piece this is kind of written in prose and it's called Home Depot. I walked in and the first thing I saw was the unbelievable brightness in the light fixture section. I went there and strolled, squinting up and down the aisles, lamps, chandeliers, patio lanterns, and Home Depot's own lights shining not for sale above them all. It was, I believe, the same dazzling brilliance I'll see dying one day. A few rows away, I saw bathtubs standing up against the wall. I never knew how tall a bathtub could be. Then I drifted into the kitchen installments. I opened the empty faucets, even though I knew nothing would happen. I shut them again and stood there a few minutes alone. And the kitchen suddenly held the same quiet mystery for me as a ruin. From the paint section, I took a free booklet of Glacier white color strips. They were pale, incredibly faint shades. What made me want them? Maybe of all the colors, they are the ones that needed me the most. That was me in the Home Depot when it first opened here in Kingston. And most people were there just shopping. And I was just wandering around with my notebook trying to get a few things.
Shopping for images.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that. I never realized how tall a bathtub could be.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just being, that's allowing yourself to be surprised in the moment, right? Like,
right.
You know, you can't think of that unless you see a bathtub, you know, standing upright.
Okay. You said there was something in the back of
that notebook? Oh, yeah. Yeah. The back of this notebook that has all these poems in it, as I was sending these poems out to journals, they came back rejected. And I wrote down the rejections in handwriting in the back. So I have them here from Event Magazine, September 1997. They say, well enough express melancholy, but not terribly enlightening. They drag you down. This is from Prism Magazine, September 30th. I would encourage you to send to us again. Sometimes it takes a while before we think we're hearing your proper voice. The frustrated emotional state you convey in these poems is well done, makes the reader anxious, which it should. The way you use line breaks adds to this. In Awake, does the mosquito or the blood belong to them both? I think some clarity there would be good. Thanks for letting us consider these.
I think some clarity there would be good. Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, you know, they're not wrong. It's just interesting to kind of read this. This is from Fiddlehead. They used to do these great rejection notes. So you always look forward to getting rejected by them. They say some wonderful images, tossing with long dreams, unchewed hours. You develop these poems extremely well. I even like the occasional rhyme. However, the ends of the poems do not do justice to the preceding development. Leave the reader with something more compelling to think about. Try us again. And there's one more here from Fiddlehead. A few months later, I must have just been bombarding them. Thanks for your submission. Unfortunately, we cannot accept it for publication. The subject matter of these poems is interesting. However, the implications could be explored a bit more. Consider some of the possibilities in the images you create. So that's kind of how, I don't know about you, but I wasn't someone, and I'm still not really, that kind of joins writing groups to kind of, you know, peer review my work. So
right.
I was just kind of writing on my own, sending stuff out on my own. And I kind of use literary journals as sounding boards. You know, if a poem got accepted, I'd be, oh, that's great. That's fantastic. I don't have to look at it again. If it came back, I'd say, why did it come back? Maybe I'll change it around. So I really did rely on their comments quite a bit to not really to change. You can't really, you know, change the way you write, but just become more aware of why I was writing the way I was writing.
They're so specific. Actually,
they are. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're very specific. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I've got hundreds of rejections from all over the place, and usually it's just thank you for your submission.
Form letter.
Very rarely would you get
feedback like that.
Any kind of feedback. Yeah,
yeah.
Apart from maybe, you know, we'd be interested in seeing some more. Maybe.
Yeah.
If you ever get better, you know. Oh, right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So your short story collection came out early this year.
Yeah.
How was that? You know, did you do a lot of readings? Did you have a book tour? What did it entail?
Yeah, had a few readings. Didn't have much of a book tour. Had a few little spots here and there that I was reading. I have some festival events coming up. The Kingston Writers Festival at the end of this month. Going to the Windsor Book Festival on October 15th. And that's all to help promote the book. So, hitting a few spots that I've been to, trying a few new spots. But it's been a great experience. The writing of the book was really the best memory of the whole thing.
Okay. So you've got this new book out. Survivors of the Hive, another great title. Like I said, your titles are fantastic. Cool cover too. Like it's a beautiful looking book.
Yeah. Thank you.
And then did you say you're working on something else? Or there's something else coming out?
Breaking news. It hasn't been, cause I'm not, the title has not been finalized yet, but, a collection of prose poems is coming out next fall with, Guernica Press.
Are you batting around titles or is this you arguing with the press about the title or
the original title? Yeah, maybe we'll test it out right now. You can let me know what you think. Okay.
Okay. Sure.
The title that I submitted it with, that they accepted it as, was called Scrambled Wonderland.
Mm.
When I was kind of looking for some back cover blurbs, David Keplinger, a great poet in the States, he came back and said that he wasn't, a fan of that title. He said there's another line in here that he thinks might work better. And that line was like a trophy from the sun.
Mm.
Then that's from a piece in the book that's where the line is, carry your shadow through this world like a trophy from the sun.
Yeah. I like that actually.
Yeah.
I do like that. Like a trophy from the sun. Yeah. I think I like that a little better. Yeah.
Okay. And the thing with Scrambled Wonderland is that it does call back to, again, Murakami, I think Hard Boiled Wonderland and the End of the World.
Yeah.
He has that title. So it's very similar to that.
And it may also sort of suggest, like, it's all weird, man. It's all scrambled and weird.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, a trophy from the sun has, wow.
Some clarity. Yeah.
Not only clarity, but heroic clarity. Like, you know, I somebody in one of those plumed helmets with a that's what comes to mind for me, like, wow, yeah, with a spear, yeah, in the desert.
Right on. Okay, that's, yeah, that's, I think I've made my decision now. We'll okay. see what the publisher yeah,
see what they say. And that's coming out next fall, right?
Yeah, in the fall. And I'm working on something now that's so much fun, man. It's just so great. It's a lot. It started off as a bit about a memoir about my own experiences with poetry, and it kind of turned into a bit of a parody of a self-help book. But it's actually transforming into an experimental novel, and it's called How to Stop Writing Poetry.
Mm.
And it's just been a blast to write. So, that's still kind of, you know, working on it. So there's no dates for that, but that's what's my, where my,
but that's good to hear that it's a blast to write. I mean, that's,
yeah,
if it ever stops being that, you know, got to think of something else to do all day long, right?
I think so. I mean, it's hard enough just to sit here and do it. And if you don't have to enjoy every moment, it's hard work, of course, too. And it takes time and it's just frustrating. But if it's, there's got to be enough of it to be fun. Otherwise, really, yeah, dude, life is just too short. I mean, if you're not enjoying it, do something else.
Well, again, in that introduction to the flame, that quote from Cohen, where he says, "Nothing else has given me so much satisfaction as blackening pages."
Right? Yeah, I love the way he says that, blackening pages. That's exactly what it is, right? It's not expressing your innermost, you know, soul. It's blackening the pages. Yeah.
There is something so deeply satisfied for me, sounds like to you too, for you too, of finishing a notebook or moving on to the next. And in fact, I'm always eyeballing the next one when I'm getting it, you know, can't wait to start that one. But you wouldn't do it if it didn't give some sort of deep pleasure and satisfaction, right?
Yeah. Like,
I'm never sure what it is. It is just blackening pages, actually.
Yeah.
That's the real pleasure. It's not finishing a piece. It's not seeing a piece published.
No.
It's not selling books. It's blackening the pages,
blackening
isn't it?
Blackening the pages. He really put his finger on it. And you know what? It's calling back to, you know, my earlier memory of just kind of scribbling in those books, right? With the crayons. I mean, that's for some reason, that was, I just love that. Even though nothing was inspiring me. It was just that, getting it out there, right?
I may use that as the title for this episode, Blackening Pages with Jason Brewer. Does that sound good? Yeah.
That sounds amazing. Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. Well, thank you very much, man.
Thanks, Jason. This was a lot of fun, man.
It was a lot of fun and went way over the 1 hour.
But
like you said, if you're having a conversation, then it's,
that's
the whole point of it. Okay. Yeah. Thanks again. Let me just stop recording and then we'll do the final stuff. But thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, welcome to the end of the podcast as we know it. Thank you for listening all the way to the end. I do appreciate that. What do you think, Sasha?
I don't hear you, so...
You don't listen to my podcast, do you?
Yeah.
No. Oh, well. It was great to get to know Jason a little bit. Really enjoyed the chat. He's a good guy. Go buy his books. Okay, what else? Sasha, what's cracking?
I don't know.
What am I reading? What are you reading?
Manga.
What manga are you reading?
Kochikame.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm reading?
No,
you don't know, do you? Yeah. You don't care either, do you?
Yeah.
Right. I just finished a book called Opposable Thumbs, How Siskel and Ebert Changed Movies Forever. Quite enjoyable. That was a big show for me when I was a kid. You like movies, Sasha?
Yeah.
What movies do you like?
300.
300, yeah, that's a big one for you, huh? What else? What's your favorite Rocky movie?
That Drago.
The one with Drago, Rocky IV. Okay, what's your favorite Indiana Jones movie?
The new one? Yeah, no, new.
All right. What's your favorite episode of my podcast?
I don't hear you. I don't listen.
Yeah,
so.
I know. So you don't know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was a pretty big year for my podcast, man. What happened? What's happening? Oh, someone's phoning? They're calling me. Hello? Yeah. Right. Okay.
Got it. Yep. Bye.
Hmm. That's interesting for the listeners, huh? What else? What am I listening to? What are you listening to, Sasha? What music do you like these days? What's your favorite Prince song? I'm going down.
No. I please get.
Your favorite song?
Yeah, you know, right?
Black Sweat?
No.
Raspberry Beret?
No.
I could never take the place of your man?
Maybe.
Ding, 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 yeah. Ding, 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 ding. Oh, really? That's your favorite Prince song?
Yeah.
That's a great choice, man. Okay. It's not my favorite Prince song, but I don't know that I have one. Okay, what else? What else is happening? Oh, I wanted to go check out, I mentioned it on the podcast, go check out Ex Libris. I believe that's how you pronounce it. Sasha, is that right?
I don't know.
You don't know, do you? Let me, Ex Libris, I believe is the correct pronunciation, but let's try it. Is this entertainment for the people, man?
Ex Libris.
Ex Libris. There. Okay. Ex Libris Anonymous. They make super duper cool notebooks out of old books. They take the covers and, as Jason and I talked about, not a sponsor or anything. I just wanted to point people in their direction because they're super cool. Like, Sasha, look at this. Isn't this a cool notebook?
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Hardy Boys. And then blank pages. See?
Hmm.
What do you think? Super cool, right? What happened at midnight?
I don't know.
Sasha? You don't know what happened at midnight?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else you want to say to the people, Sasha?
It's okay.
How about Happy New Year?
Happy New Year.
Year of the Dragon. Hope everything works out.
Mm.
Yeah?
Cool.
Well, thank you very much, Sasha. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Very merry.
Happy New Year.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. And back in 3 weeks with more wonderful content, right? Even better than this.